we're glad you're here tonight. And especially we want to try to make our visitors feel welcome. We're talking about a subject that I think is critical to the creation-evolution controversy, and I'm a little disturbed when I hear some of my brethren saying it doesn't really matter, and I think they haven't thought about it that much. Certainly, if the earth is young, then the ball game's over. We all go home. There's no time for evolution. And the picture that we see in Genesis, the first three chapters, just makes perfect sense. If it's billions of years old, that wouldn't necessarily refute the idea, though I think it would make it very difficult to harmonize. I really don't think that is compatible with the early chapters of Genesis. But it's absolutely essential for the concept of evolution. And, of course, there are many scientists who believe that the Earth is billions of years old, and when you hear the TV programs, public TV, radio, over and over the mantra, this is so many billion years old, so many million years old, and they always explain how they reach that conclusion, don't they? Or do they? No, they just affirm it like a mantra, over and over and over, and once you've heard it for several hundred times, then it sounds rather strange to hear somebody saying something different, but certainly not all scientists. There are thousands of highly credentialed scientists who believe the evidence indicates that the Earth is young, and they really don't want you to know that. One would be Russell Humphreys, who has a PhD in physics from LSU. He's a geophysicist, was 30 years at Sandia National Laboratory, credited with several hundred patents. His conclusion is that most of the age indicators, at least 90% of them, favor a young Earth. He says there are at least 100, maybe 200, and almost all of them indicate a young Earth. We're told, for example, that the radiometric dating favors the old Earth, and that's almost always the first thing that comes up. If a rock is 4 billion years old, then obviously the Earth has to be that old. And that's where the discussion begins. He lists at least 12 reasons why there's a clear indication of a young age of the Earth in a presentation I heard him make just a month or so ago. I wish you had time, we had time to go through this. I'll look at some indicators of the young Earth when we conclude this evening. But there are many who do not believe, that is, credentialed scientists, who think that the evidence favors a young Earth. But you cannot be an evolutionist and believe it's young. That's just an absolute essential. And to understand the implications and the significance of this issue, notice the statement by George Wald, who is a Nobel laureate from Harvard, and he's talking about the origin of life. And with the complexities that we know about, he reaches the conclusion that the interdependent complexities, the machinery that we talked about Monday evening, machines are observed to be designed, and here they are. How do you get this naturally? And he says it's not possible. One has only to contemplate the magnitude of this task to concede that spontaneous generation of a living organism is impossible. Yet, here we are. And of course, there's no consideration of the possibility of God. That's just, you got your blinders on, you can't look in that direction. Since we're here, then I believe in spontaneous generation, though you look at the evidence and it's impossible. And that is the thinking that we see over and over. However improbable we regard this event or any of the steps in which it involves, given enough time, it will almost certainly happen at least once. So you see the role that time plays in their thinking. Now, what we learned about time last night tells us that with time, things get more organized or less organized. It goes downhill. Time is not a organizing factor. It's a disorganizing factor. That's impotent to do the miracle that he wants to be done, but he says time is the hero of the plot. Given so much time, the impossible becomes possible. The possible probable, the probable virtually certain. One has only to wait, and time itself performs the miracles. So, here is the Holy Spirit of the evolutionist performing miracles. And what we know about time and the second law of thermodynamics says precisely the opposite, if you're going to be a scientist. But fairy tales creep into science. And most of us are familiar with the fairy tale where the princess kisses the frog, and then that frog turns into a prince, which we know is a fairy tale, unless that magic kiss is time, and then it's science. Because with time, yes, that frog does turn into the prince. Just give it enough time. That's science, according to our university system today, and we're spending billions of dollars to teach that. I don't think that's good science. I don't think time has that power, and that's what we're going to be looking at this evening. One of the good ways to begin any question in science, when people are convinced of something that doesn't seem to be supported by science, I like to ask why questions. Why do you believe the earth is old? And that's a pretty good way to start. And when you do, on this subject, almost invariably, they begin with radiometric dating systems, radioactivity. This is material that's not stable. Particles are ejected from the nucleus, alpha or beta particles, and by this process, it decays and becomes something else, other products. And things like uranium-238, that are very heavy, big molecules, 238 particles, decay over time. They're not stable. And through a series of other elements, wind up as lead-206 at the bottom, which is constant. Now, there's lead that occurs naturally as well as result of radiogenic decay. And you have to guess at how much each is the ratio in order to reach conclusions here. But this is supposed to tell time like an hourglass. And using the equation that you see at the bottom, you can see how they reach a very precise conclusion about it. What could go wrong with the kind of time-telling mechanism that we see illustrated here? Like an hourglass. If this is an hour, and it takes an hour for the sand to run down from the top to the bottom, what could go wrong with that mechanism? If before you looked and were asked how much time had transpired, you could look at this and say, well, what, 20 minutes? Maybe 16, 17 minutes, something. And if you could count the grains of sand, which we can do very precisely in the analogy, almost to atoms in the decay process, then you could come to a very precise conclusion, assuming that the rate is constant. But suppose just before you were asked the question and reached the conclusion, say 17 minutes, somebody lifted the lid, dumped in a lot of extra sand at the top so that most of it had already run down to the bottom, an hour's worth, but now then they put a lot of extra up in the top and closed it back. They say, now, how much time? That's going to mess up your calculation. Or if they lowered the base and let out a good bit of the sand that had already run down there, it may look like it's only 15 minutes worth, but it was actually much more than that. You've got to have a closed system so that things don't add or subtract, leach, or be added, which is exactly the kind of thing that you find in, for instance, petrification. The water leaches through the rocks. You add, you subtract this, you add that, and you've got calcium carbonate forming the seashell, and it becomes pyrite metal by reducing and leaching and adding. So this happens all the time. Suppose just before you looked, it was laying on its side virtually like this, and then they set it up and said, okay, now look, how much time? And it's been 15 seconds, and you say 15 minutes. So you got to know the beginning conditions. Notice the description by Henry Fall, one of the leading authorities in this field. He says there are two important assumptions implicit in this equation, the one there at the bottom. First, that we're dealing with a closed system. Second, that no atoms of the daughter, that's what's produced at the bottom, in this case the lead, were present in the system when it formed. You got to know the beginning conditions. And those are assumptions. Sometimes people say, well, they dated the rock. Well, literally, no, they have not. Rocks are not clocks. You can measure sample activity, and then through a series of assumptions, you reach a conclusion about the age. But how valid are the assumptions? That determines how valid your conclusion is. He says these assumptions furnish the most serious limitations on the accumulation clock. Rigorously closed systems probably do not exist in nature, but it's got to be closed in order to work. And especially when you're looking at thousands, millions, even billions of years, there's a lot of leaking in and leaking out. Surprisingly, many minerals and rocks satisfy the requirement well enough to be useful for nuclear age determination. The problem is one of judicious geologic selection. So you judiciously chuck if it doesn't work, and you judiciously grab it and don't dump it, but hold on to it if it happens to come out. Now, that may sound like I'm overstating the case, but I think that's an understatement. Let me illustrate with the evolutionist description of how they date themselves. With the 1470 skull, for example, a very important bit of evidence when we're talking about fossil man that we'll look at, Lord willing, Friday evening. Richard Leakey found this, and he wanted to make sure he had the very precise answer, and so he waited, because there at Cambridge they were coming up with an even better potassium-argon system, which was being, and so he got the latest and greatest and most accurate, and it came out to 2.61 plus or minus 0.26 million years. Boy, that sounds very precise, doesn't it? And this is Roger Lewin, who is writing about this. He's a good friend of Leakey. They've written books together. He was editor of Research, News, and Science. He believes in the system. But he says this is the first age which, to anthropologists unfamiliar with the procedures of radiometric dating, you see, if you're unfamiliar with that, don't feel rained on. There's anthropologists in the same boat. They just take it to the lab and say, here. Of course, if you do take a sample to the lab, you've got to tell them where it came from and what age you expect, or they won't do the test. If you don't believe that, you just look up the labs on the web and see the form you have to fill out, and you have to tell them. Now, when I was in school, I didn't get the answers before I took the test. But they have to have it first. Anyway, this has a comforting ring of precision about it. He says there were 41 separate age determinations. They did this 41 times. This skull got around. Lots of dates. Which varied between 223 million and 0.91. Less than one. Less than one to 223. Now that's just all over the place. 41 different times. One time, they got the 2.61. And so that's what they published. That's what they were looking for. They chucked 40 and kept the 1. Now, does that sound like science to you? That's judiciously, in the sense of, I'm going to make my side work and win, and make the other side lose, and you just pick the answer that you like from a wide range. Sometimes what we call the proof of the pudding type arguments are some of the clearest demonstrations, without getting into the details, which I'm not going to try to do, so don't get worried about that. This is a picture of the Mount St. Helens caldera after it exploded, and in the center you see the diabase sill that has been extruded after the initial explosion, and we know exactly when that happened. That was 1986. Five samples were taken in 1997, 11 years later, from this central core that we knew the date of, and we sent them to the UCLA dating lab for potassium-argon dating. The result was expectedly in millions, ranging from 500,000 all the way to 3 million for rock that was actually 11 years old. And some would say, well, this stuff that came out, the lava, then actually you're not starting at zero, which of course is the case. The assumption is when it's lava, it's flowing, all of the argon gas escapes, and so you reset the clock. And they measure the amount of argon that then accumulates. Well, obviously it didn't all escape, which means it doesn't work. And this is a very effective test of that. Probably the system that we hear most about involves radiocarbon dating. Sometimes that's generically used to refer to all the systems, but it's a very special kind of radiometric dating. There are about 20 different types. But this was one of the early ones. Libby won a Nobel Prize for this. And there are all kinds of problems. This Nobel Prize was, I think, 1949. But Robert Lee says it should be no surprise, he's writing the Anthropological Journal of Canada, that fully half of the dates are rejected. In my experience, that is an understatement. I was several years ago at the Ball State Carbon 14 dating lab with a friend, a brother, who believes the Earth's billions of years old, and he behaves himself as a gentleman. We have good conversations about it. But he was dating a peat bog, which he was sure was 20,000 years old. He was on his 19th try at that time. All of them had come out just a few thousand years old. He was sure it was contaminated with recent material. And he said, Don, we're going to get a good one yet. But he checked the first 19. So I think this is an understatement. Fully half are rejected. The wonder is surely the remaining half come out to be accepted, which I would agree with. There are gross discrepancies. The chronology is uneven and relative, and the accepted dates are actually selected dates. This is not science. Anytime you perform an experiment and you chuck data, you disqualify yourself as a scientist. When you pick this to the exclusion of the other results, you're just playing games. And this is what the process often is. It's a game played to confirm what you already believe. One of the best tests that has been performed of late involved the RATE project, an 8-year project that involved a number of different tests, but by some highly qualified scientists, John Bumgardner, PhD in geophysics and space physics from UCLA, staff scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and then Russell Humphreys that we introduced earlier, and then Stephen Austin, PhD in geology from Penn State, and Andrew Snelling, PhD in geology from the University of Sydney. These are not lightweights, and they know what they're doing, but they determined to do some dating of things that are not normally dated with carbon-14. They decided to date dinosaur fossils. Now, the normal scientist would say, wait a minute, this is crazy. Because all the carbon-14 would be gone at least 100,000 years, probably 60,000. It doesn't really go beyond that date. It has a short half-life, 5,730. Half of it's gone, and then another 5,730, another half. You do that about five times, and you don't have a whole lot left. All would be gone, certainly in 100,000. Dinosaurs are supposed to be 65 million years old at least, and so certainly 65 million, all gone in 100,000, should be none. And so it's crazy, they would say, to try to date a dinosaur bone with carbon-14. Well, let's just try it and see. And they did, along with diamonds, which are supposed to be billions of years old, which, of course, are carbonaceous material, supposed to obviously billions of years old, they're not going to have any carbon-14. The fact of the matter is all should have none, but all of the dates, over 100 of the dinosaur bones, all had significant amounts of carbon-14, far above the background level and far above what could be accounted for by radiation from the environment. Significant amounts, 100 times above the background level. Now, what does that say? If it's all gone in less than 100,000 years, that means these things are not 100,000 years old, doesn't it? I mean, that's just a straightforward conclusion, and the implications get it much lower than that when you see how much is there. A significant part of this project involved dating coal, and at Penn State University, where Stephen Austin had done his dissertation, this was his area of specialty. One of the objections when a creationist is doing an experiment, no matter how sophisticated he is, well, he's a creationist, he doesn't know how to do this, and so the samples are contaminated. And it's easy to get them contaminated. You have to take special care, and they know how to do that. But to avoid that objection, they got samples from the Department of Energy that they themselves had collected and then were maintained at Penn State under refrigerated conditions. Now, this is for very precise testing, much more precise than was necessary. But they didn't collect the samples. They got it from the Department of Energy, from the refrigerated conditions at Penn State, and they were taken from all across the country and all up and down the so-called geologic column, which we'll be talking about tomorrow evening. There were samples from the Eocene, supposed to be 50 million years old, all gone in 100,000, but here's coal, supposed to be 50 million years old, and then from the Cretaceous and from the Pennsylvanian, and all of them came out young and had a lot of carbon-14. They were all basically the same from top to bottom. They had the same amount of carbon-14 and all had significant amounts. What does that say? I said, they're just playing games here. This is not three times older than that one, the top and bottom. They're not millions of years old. It'd all be gone in 100,000, probably in 60,000, all gone. It's not all gone. A lot of it is still there. I think that was a profound test. And I don't think I've heard anybody try it. Well, they say, well, it had to be contaminated. It doesn't matter how much care you exercise, they've got nothing else they can say. Radiocarbon, I think, from these tests, has become the creationist friend. And we have one of the articles written by Russell Humphreys with that theme that we'll hand out with my handout this evening. We see the indication is thousands, not billions, from radiocarbon. And so, I don't think this is a good argument when you ask why you think the Earth's old. This is just not really good science. First, you have to assume that this is a closed system, and you know that doesn't exist in nature. Maybe in a few rare situations, but almost never. You have to know the beginning conditions, which we don't know. You have to guess at how much is natural, how much is radiogenic. And you have to know the rate is constant. And this may be the most significant thing that we've learned just in the last few years. We know the rate isn't constant, and I think we can prove that. We don't have time to go into detail. Maybe in the question period some of you may ask about that. When we look at known ages or known relationships, those things that are supposed to be old are not old. Those things that we know the age of, like Mount St. Helens, come out billions of years. And so I would agree with W.D. Stanfield, who's professor of biological science at Polytechnic State University, California, who is a very avid anti-creationist, who says, nevertheless, it's obvious that radiometric technique may not be the absolute methods they're claimed to be. Age estimates on a given geological stratum by different radiometric methods are often quite different, sometimes by hundreds of millions of years. And so he concludes, though he still uses it, there is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock. And I think we caught him in the truth. I don't think that's a good argument. Okay, if that's not a good argument, now back to our why question. Why do you think the earth is old? Well, maybe the geologic phenomenon. That's what we'll talk about in our second session. But let's take a break at this point and see if some of you have some questions. I know a whole lot more about the second session than I do the first, but let's see if you have some questions. Yes, sir. You know, I haven't been down there lately, nor has anyone else. We reach conclusions about that indirectly, reasonably reliably, by the S waves and P waves that go through the earth as a result of earthquakes, and the differential in the time that it takes the S wave and the P wave to get there gives you an indication about what it's going through. Everybody understood that, right? Anyway, we can indirectly infer that, and it's very deep. It's supposed to be an iron core. There are many things that are inconsistent with the present theories, and they're being revised at all time. What we're living on the crust of the earth, is teeny tiny. Now, it doesn't seem that way. It's like 5 miles or more, up to 15 sometimes, thick. But that's roughly analogous to the skin on an apple, whereas the core would be roughly analogous to the central metallic core. That'll give you a basic concept. Other questions? Everybody understood all of that? The constant rate is one of the assumptions that, let me take time out here and navigate to a section where I had time to deal with that. We've done experiments that I think are very significant, very profound. Especially Russell Humphreys. That's not the slide I'm looking for. Okay. This involves some work out at White Sands, New Mexico, at Fenton Hill, where they're drilling down in the granite well over a mile, to 2 miles sometimes, and looking for the zircons, little almost microscopic crystals, in the granite that contain uranium, which is radioactive and decaying. Now, in the crystal, you've got pretty much a closed system. And so in this very rare circumstance, that objection is pretty well answered here. And you've got uranium, and so it's decaying and producing lead. And so you would assume that in these zircons, that the lead that you find is from radioactive decay in the zircon. And so this is a pretty good test and an important effort. And what they found was there's about 1.5 billion years worth of radioactive decay in these closed zircons. How did that happen if the Earth's only just a few thousand years old? That's if the rates are constant, obviously. At today's rate, it would be 1.5. Well, there's an indication that maybe it wasn't constant. Yes, there is. Because as a result of uranium decay, you have helium produced. You've got uranium decays down to lead, 238 down to 206, by losing 32 particles. Each four forms one atom of helium, You got 32. How many atoms of helium will we have? 8 every time you have one atom of uranium decay. So you got a lot more helium, and it ought to be easier to measure the helium than the lead. However, helium escapes pretty quickly. It's slippery, and it's a little bitty, and at least over a long period of time, you can calculate that it would be gone. You can measure the diffusion rates very precisely. If it's really old, then it would have escaped. However, most of it's still there. It hasn't escaped. The indications are the amount that's left is the amount that would be left in less than 10,000 years. Not much of it has escaped, and that's a pretty generous estimate. So, what we've got is 1.6 billion years worth of the lead at the bottom that seems to be produced in less than 10,000 years. The helium there says this hasn't happened very long. The only way to make sense out of that is to say, well, it decayed much more rapidly. And we've been able to demonstrate some of that in the lab. And we're hypothesizing that the catastrophic circumstances of the flood are perfect for producing the accelerated radioactive decay. Now, that's not without some problems, but I think we've solved most of them, or at least got a good handle on it. But let me illustrate what I'm saying in a way that may communicate a little better to an average audience. Let's say that you're over in Greece, and one of the tour guides comes to you and says, look, we've got a really, really great discovery that I've stumbled on. There's a temple over here that hasn't been opened in over 2,000 years. Nobody has seen what's in it. Come with me, and I'll let you be with me when we open the door. And they open the door very carefully as they dig down, and it creaks. And they look inside, and there are just a lot of artifacts down here from apparently a very ancient civilization. Wow, this is an amazing discovery. And then you look around, and you see there are helium balloons up on the ceiling. Wait a minute, nobody's been in here for 2,000 years and you've got these balloons full. What happens in a week? They're going to be on the floor, right? The helium says, no, I don't think so. This can't be old. And that's what you're finding in the zircons. The helium are like the helium balloons. It says, no way. And so we have real good evidence for a varying decay rate. That's one example. There are others. Now, I get a little carried away with some questions. I told the kids the other night, I remind myself of the question my daughter asked me when she said, Daddy, briefly, what time is it? But the zircons in the helium, I think, are very significant. All right, let me see if I can navigate back. So we're ready to take off here in a minute. And who else would have a question? Just a second here. Okay. Yes, sir. It becomes very difficult to drill 5 miles down. There are some who apparently have done that. Most of them are not going to go more than a mile or 2 or 3 miles. But there are some that have claimed to do that. And it punches through, and we find different stuff, but there's no catastrophic results. You don't punch through and strike oil or anything. But it's an interesting experiment. One of the problems when you're drilling down that far is that the crust is not like this table. It shifts and moves. And when it moves with that drill in it, it's going to pinch it. And it's hard. You got to do it quick. And it's hard to do a quick 5-mile deep hole. So it's a major challenge. Yes. That's coming up in the next session. Absolute. Oil takes a long time, about 2 hours. Coal, maybe 6. In the lab. You've heard all about that? Actually, it's been published, and they just don't like material like that, so the press doesn't get very excited about it. All right, our time is up for this session. Let's move quickly. And then if you have further questions, just hold those and we'll try to get to them in the second session. Now, why? And the next response usually involves the geologic phenomenon. It looks old. I mean, you look at the layers and the fossils and the oil and the coal. And obviously, it has to be old. Doesn't look that way to me as a geologist, and those who are knowledgeable understand what I'm talking about. The geologic layers that cover the continents, an average of about a mile and a half, of sedimentary layer, water-laid rock with billions of dead things in it, cover the continents. How fast did this form? Well, we're told in the stratigraphy textbooks that the sedimentation rates postulated by Schuster, who did this back in 1931, it's still repeated in the modern textbooks, look like this. In the Paleozoic, which is the majority of it, it's almost 3,000 years a foot. To form 1 foot of limestone, sandstone, 3,000 years. Now, actually, that's a pretty rapid rate according to what's being touted today. For example, in the great dinosaur extinction controversy here, two well-known atheistic geologists say, no, it's not the rate of Schuster. It's 1 centimeter per 1,000 years. 1 centimeter per 1,000 years. Now, that's very different. Schuster said about 1 foot in 3,000 years. He's saying about 1 foot in 30,000 years. And yet, both of them sound very precise. And when you read it in the textbook, you think, wow, that's got to be right. One of them's not right. Obviously, dramatically. That's the equivalent of 2.5 inches in 1,000 years. But is that what we see indicated in the rocks? And the answer is absolutely no. Notice the observation by Dunbar and Rogers in the book Principles of Stratigraphy. He's talking about the implications of these findings of radiometric dating and what they're telling them about the age with what they see in the rocks. He says, to some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery, billions of years, presented a dilemma. Now, some would think those that study the rocks would expect this, but no, he said, this is a problem. For if the known stratified rocks have been accumulating throughout this vast span of time, the average rate of deposition must have been extremely slow, and yet there is very good evidence that individual beds accumulated rapidly. Now, he's not a friend of the creationist, but you look at the rocks, and this is a problem. What's he talking about? What kind of good evidence? Now, we look at this shrimp. Looks like a shrimp, doesn't it? It's not. It's a rock. But, question, how long did it take that rock to form? Think about it. That won't hurt. Let's just think a little bit here. What's going to happen to that shrimp as it lays out there on the beach for a day, 2 days, 10 days? What's going to happen? Is it going to look like that? 1 centimeter per 1,000 years? What is that? I mean, that's crazy. Not possible. Very good evidence that individual beds accumulated rapidly. You'll see in the museum in the back several examples of the shrimp that are not going to last. I mean, you ladies know you can put it in the refrigerator and it'll just last years and years and years. No. And it's not going to be preserved like this at the rate of 2.5 inches per 1,000 years. This is a fish in the process of eating his supper. I enjoy eating with my brethren. And sometimes some of them are a little slow in eating, and it may get a little aggravating. But, you know, 100,000 years is kind of silly. How long did it take him to get caught eating his supper? He got caught in the concrete, didn't he? That had to happen rapidly, or that's not going to happen. And you'll see an example of this, an actual fish eating another fish in the rock in the back. I've got two or three more at home, bigger, that we didn't bring. But there are numerous examples. They're not really that unusual. That says, hey, this did not happen at the rate they're talking about in the textbooks. That's just crazy. And then at the Cumberland Mountains up above Knoxville, Tennessee, we see in this coal seam that I'm sitting on that they've cut down to it and in the process exposed what they call a polystrate fossil, many strata that are covered by hundreds and hundreds of layers which formed at the rate of 3,000 years a foot, if you want to do it fast. What's going to happen to the top of that tree? And it's not really a tree, it's a fern. This is over 12 feet from the bottom coal seam up to another coal seam and extends through both of them. I think both coal seams were laid down together in order to preserve this kind of a tree. We find this fairly commonly in England and here in Nova Scotia. And as you look carefully at this area and back up a little bit, you see that, wow, there's all kind of examples of the polystrate trees in the area. Now, as we think about the age and how long it took to cover this, how much time is involved, Schuster, at his rate, would say it took 32 years to cover 32,000 years. 32 years wouldn't work. But 32,000 years to cover this 12-foot tree, Officer and Drake's rate would be 360,000 years. You buy that? That's just not going to fly. I think there's a better explanation for that. I think this is one catastrophic event. A flood would dump sediment that would cover trees standing upright. And I think that's very obviously what we're looking at here. We're told, of course, that oil takes millions and millions of years, and the reason they give for that... Now, I hadn't heard it either. Rapid oil, that sounds crazy to a lot of people, but ironically, in Discover magazine, they're reporting on a factory that's working up in Indiana. Anything into oil is the title of the article. Turkey guts, junked car parts, even raw sewage going one end of the plant. Black gold comes out the other end 2 hours later. They're trying to work to not use as much energy as they produce so they can show a profit. Not try to make it up in volume if they're short. But right now they are producing this, and there are some places in Australia where they're showing a profit in the energy that's produced. It doesn't take a long time to produce oil. You take garbage plus pressure and temperature, and in a short time, you've got oil. In fact, that's what they're doing in Nashville with a plant there, turning the garbage into oil as part of their garbage disposal process. Many of you have seen fossils like this. This is in coal. Beautiful fern fossils. How long does it take a fern to wilt? This one hasn't wilted at all, has it? But the rock formed before it had time to wilt. Now, how long did it take the rock to form? Just think about it. And then we look at the fossil form up top and then the fern at the bottom held over in a bent unnatural position, and it turned into a rock before it sprang back, before it had time to wilt. Formed at the rate of 2.5 years a thousand, or a thousand years, 2.5 inches for 1,000 years. Here, just this year, in Science Daily, the preservation, and he's talking about ferns, happened so quickly that some of the cells have been preserved during diligent stages, or different stages of cell division. They found cell nuclei, cell membranes, even individual chromosomes. Royal ferns look essentially the same now, this is a different point, but we'll get a little ahead of ourselves, as they did during the Jurassic period. That's where the dinosaurs were, and are therefore an excellent example of what we call a living fossil. We look at fossil reptiles like this, the ichthyosaur. This one is 28 feet long, beautifully preserved in the Solenhofen limestone from Barbaria, formed at the rate of 3,000 years a foot. You buy that? I mean, that's just nuts. And you look at some of the fossils, and you can see even the adipose tissue, the fatty, soft tissue in the head that is preserved there in the rock. And then looking closer at Mrs. Ichthyosaur, you see the embryo inside. And there are a number of them at this particular location that obviously got into trouble in a big storm or something that agitated them, and they all were involved, or at least a dozen or so of them involved in giving premature birth. And we see here baby ichthyosaur in the process of coming out of the birth canal. Now, I can sympathize with the ladies. They may think this process takes 100,000 years. They've seen that, but not really. And that's not possible to explain that slowly. A very good example of it was found earlier this year. And here we see described the capture. They capture the moment of live birth with a baby emerging from the pelvis of its mother. It's captured at the rate of 3,000 years a foot. I don't think so. It's captured like being caught in the concrete. It did not form slowly. If you're willing to look at that and think, I think that should be obvious. And then we see things like octopuses, or whatever you call them. They're squishy, gushy. Sometimes you say, well, you don't have the kind of fossils you need in the gaps because they have soft tissue. Well, here's an octopus that's beautifully preserved. Not only the octopus, but the ink in that it shoots to preserve itself is preserved. Preservation of an octopus as a fossil, complete with ink and suckers, is about as unlikely as finding a fossil sneeze, if you believe their dogma. These things are 95 million years old, yet one of the fossils is almost indistinguishable for living species. I can't help but kind of get ahead of ourselves a little bit to the next point, but looking at the nature of the fossils, we understand what Dunbar and Rogers is saying. There's good evidence when you look at the rocks that these billions of years won't work. Many of you have marveled at the jellyfish. I was presenting this to a junior high group not long ago, and I asked the kids, what's a jellyfish made of? One of the little girls just waved her hand. She says, it's made out of snot. Well, that's not far off, is it? But it is substantial enough to be preserved in the fossil record. Now, the octopus and the jellyfish washed up here on the beach, and they're going to last how long? You can even see the mouth parts of some of the preserved features here, along with the ripple marks, which are very ephemeral. Numbers of them, hundreds of them, there in this site in Pennsylvania. So I believe we can say unreservedly that science indicates that fossils did not form slowly. You hear the propaganda, it takes millions of years. Why? look at the fossils and think, no, it's not possible. Don't buy it. It's not so. There is very good evidence that the individual beds accumulated rapidly. And it's getting more obvious when we see soft tissue preserved, especially in examples like this. Here's almost a little soft, squishy worm up top. Other soft tissue preserved. The Burgess shell preserves soft tissue in exquisite detail. And the question of how this came happens has troubled scientists since the discovery in 1900. If it takes millions of years, yeah, that's pretty troubling. I can understand that. But if you go with the facts, you ought not to be troubled to just accept what it says. But if you think the hard preservation of soft tissue is a challenge to our present standard thinking, what about preserved soft tissue that's still soft? Now, that would really be troubling, wouldn't it? Here we see blood cells, T-Rex blood cells, supposed to be 65 million years old. And this was published back in 93. Mary Schweitzer got in all kind of trouble for publishing that. Almost didn't finish her doctorate, but eventually did. Since then, she's found much more of it and published pictures of the soft, squishy material, the blood vessels, the tendons, that are soft and pliable in the 65 million year old dinosaur bones. In Discover, it was reported, she said, I had one reviewer tell me he didn't care what the data said. He knew that what I was finding wasn't possible. It doesn't matter. Facts, just don't worry about them. And so, she wrote back and said, well, what data would convince you? And he said, none. And I think he was telling the truth. She is very uncomfortable because she likes to have the acclaim of the scientist, and she's very close to affirming the young Earth, though, I mean, the evidence shouts that. She's trying not to say. I was speaking to her back in 2005, and she acknowledged our current theories do not account for soft tissue and cellular preservation, certainly not for 65 million years. We don't know how that happened. And since then, she has reported in the analysis of some bones here in 2012 more evidence for the preservation of ancient dinosaur proteins. Now, proteins degrade rapidly, but we've got the intact assembled proteins and possibly DNA, and some of the fellows that work with her tell me they have definitely found the DNA, but she won't come out flat-footed and say so. She said maybe. Because we can show in the laboratory it can't last more than 10,000 years. And here it is in a 65-million-year-old dinosaur bone. So she's treading lightly. But when we look at squishy, stretchy blood vessels and blood cells and soft tissue, including definitely intact proteins and probably DNA, and that just says very definitely dinosaur fossils are not old. They're just not. Can't be. Now think about the implications of that. If the fossils in the layers are not old, what does that tell you about the layers? It says the layers can't be old, does it? And if that's the case, then where's the time? Well, it gets rather uncomfortable if you're trying to affirm the time, but they do have an answer now, and today's answer to that question is it's in between the layers. They know the individual layers formed rapidly, and most paleontologists, at least a majority, would acknowledge that. Okay, where's the time? It's in between, where there is no evidence. Well, actually, there is evidence, and it's negative. But let's not misrepresent. Let's notice the statement by Derek Ager, past president of the British Geological Association. He says, we cannot escape the conclusion that sedimentation was at times very rapid. Indeed, at other times, there were long breaks. Okay, yeah, we know here where we can see that it happened quickly. But there had to be breaks somewhere. Well, where? Well, there just has to be. He has faith. Though it looks, doesn't look like there are breaks, but it looks uniform and continuous, but he believes there were breaks. Now, this is not real good science. It definitely does look uniform and continuous. When we look at the layers there in Grand Canyon, for example, knife-edge interfaces say there's not erosion in between. And if this is deposited underwater, you have all kinds of bioturbidation, where you have roots that plow down through the surface, and you have worm burrows, and you have clown burrows that destroy that knife-edge surface in just a few tens of years. We've seen deposits from hurricanes that we could recognize but disappear within tens of years because of the bioturbidation. You don't see any evidence of that. Eger explains it this way. The geological record is constantly lying to us. Don't go with the evidence. It's not telling you the truth. It pretends to tell us the whole truth when it's only telling us a very small part of it. Nowhere in the world is the record or even part of it complete. There's just a whole lot more that's not there. It may seem paradoxical to me, but the gaps probably cover most of Earth history. Now, where's the evidence? Well, it's in the gap where it's not there. It was during the breaks that most of the events probably occurred. Now, when most of your conclusion is based on zero, I'd say you got a pretty flimsy theory. He says it's the gaps that really matter, the lack of evidence, not the evidence. That's not the way I was taught to do science. When you look at the gaps, you look, for example, here down near the base of Grand Canyon, you see the Coconino sandstone right on top of the Hermit Shell with a knife edge. It looks like there's much erosion going on there in between. There's supposed to be 110 million years in between is missing as you go from the Hermit Shell to the Coconino sandstone. You don't see anything like that, an indication of any kind of erosion. It's straight and smooth contact line for 300 miles, all the way up and down the canyon. We know what erosion looks like, and time produces erosion. Not as much time as they would imagine. This was actually produced in about 10 years. But when you have exposure to the surface, you have erosion, and that's not what you see. It looks uniform and continuous. And we look at the contact lines. There is evidence there. We see little bird tracks. We see raindrop impressions and ripple marks, which would be erased within just tens of years if they're exposed at the surface. First, you have to have the initial layer formed rapidly in order to preserve something like that, and then you have to have the next layer quickly in order to keep it from eroding. Like what you see here at Glen Rose with the dinosaur tracks, they step, and the next big rain, they're gone, right? But you've got ripple marks perfectly preserved. The host layer has to be rapid in order to preserve these ephemeral markings, and then the next layer has to be rapid to prevent the subsequent erosion of those ephemeral markings. To form it has to be quick. To keep it from eroding, it has to be quick. And then every layer that you get to, they say if you follow any layer far enough, you'll find ripple marks. It's the most ubiquitous feature in the fossil record. Virtually all layers have ripple marks, which says this was not slow. And in virtually all of them, then, this one and that one, on top of it, you've got ripple marks. So this one and that one, all the way from top to bottom, says rapid. I like to look at the fossil record. That's my briar patch, if they want to look at evidence for the age of the Earth. I think it says dramatically the opposite. But even more obvious is a careful look at some of the interfaces. For example, Here we see the red wall. That's maybe the most distinctive, recognizable feature of Grand Canyon. Underneath it, directly underneath it, is the Muav Cambrian. Now, red wall is not quite halfway up, but well over a third of the way up the geologic column. Cambrian is the bottom layer. Supposed to be at least 150 million years between the red wall and the Muav. But here they are on top of each other. But when you look carefully, you see you go from the Muav to the red wall and then back to the Muav. How do you skip 150 million years and then go back and get some more? And then you do it again and again and again, back and forth and back and forth, eight times. How do you skip 150 million years eight times? And not just skip it, that's half of the problem. You can go back and get some of the older that's been gone for 150 million years to put on top of. We were taught in stratigraphy, if you have layers that are interbedded, they are contemporaneous. They're laid down at the same time. Does that make sense? It just has to be. And that's what we see here. It proves that the layers are contemporaneous. It looks continuous, and it is continuous. It cannot be millions of years old. It has to be contemporaneous, one after the other, in rapid sequence, in order to preserve what we see in the rocks. Well, how did you get this much material, the layers, put together like this rapidly? Well, we've got a laboratory demonstration of that with Mount St. Helens. And this is the way it looked before 1980, and this is what happened in May of 1980 when it blew its top and blew tremendous amounts of material out across the countryside in a pyroclastic cloud that traveled 150 to 200 miles per hour one afternoon. And it just denuded and eroded tremendous amounts of material and blasted it across the countryside. And then Spirit Lake, which got dammed up, broke the dam and eroded right through the middle of that deposit about 600 feet of sedimentary layers that had been laid down one afternoon, then had this immense amount of water with Spirit Lake come down through there and leave this little bitty trail. And, of course, it was the little bitty trail, the little bitty trickle of water down there that cut this big canyon, you think? Or maybe a great amount of water, and this is what's left. Obviously, very analogous, very similar to what we see at Grand Canyon. If we look at the walls, we see 600-foot walls in some places, laid down almost all in one afternoon, certainly in less than 3 months total. And you see the finely laminated layers that were produced at 100 miles an hour. We were taught it had to be at least a year per layer. Go out and count the layers. You'll know how long. No. One afternoon, you got 600 feet of layers. And this looks exactly like what you see when you go down a canyon that is supposed to be millions of years old. You hit it with a hammer, and it rings like a rock. I mean, you hit this, and it rings like a bell. It's hard rock. And looks very similar to what you see at Grand Canyon. Does that look like Grand Canyon? How about that? That look. I'm sorry. This is Grand Canyon. This is the Mount St. Helens Canyon that was formed basically one afternoon. It kind of reminds me of the cartoon a friend of mine drew. This million-year-old canyon was formed by Mount St. Helens in 1980. You've seen signs like that. Of course, when we go to caves, we're told these things take hundreds of thousands of years to form, the speleotherms, the stalactites and stalagmites. Reaching all the way to the ceiling, that would be many, many years. My textbook at Indiana University said it took 100,000 years to form one cubic inch of this material. But what really opened my eyes was when we went to George Rogers Clark Memorial in Vincennes, Indiana, which is on the banks of the Wabash River, on a clay bank. The limestone for this building was quarried just a few miles from the cave that we just looked at. And water percolates down through the cracks in this building, just like it does in the caves, and forms the speleotherms down in the basement of the building. 5 11-foot columns were down there in a building that was 40 years old. Now, there's a whole lot more to that story where they tried to cover it up, but that's the bottom line. You go to places like Carlsbad, and you see some very large formations. Well, how fast was this forming? How much flow? How much ventilation? All of these factors affect the rate, but you can see it forming very quickly. I had a friend of mine who was doing an experiment for the National Forest Service at one of the caves down in southern Texas, Sonora, Texas, in the Sonora Caverns, which is spectacular, by the way. And he would set up a camera with time-lapse photography to try to measure the movement of some of these soda straws, as they call them. He said he came back in a month and it had already grown past the lens. It had grown all the way past it in the month, and he had to back up and get a longer view in order to get a good idea of the rate. And we can see indications of that kind of thing. Here at Carlsbad, you've got lots of bats flying around. Some of them are slow enough to get caught by a stalactite. That's a pretty slow bat, isn't it? If it's forming at the rate of 1 square inch per 100,000 years. But it's covered up before it decayed and before it flew off. I think that's a challenge to the idea it takes millions of years. Some of you got a chance to see this firsthand when I was here before. We just discovered this boot near Ira Ann, Texas. This is a regular boot. It's not fossilized, the outside of it. But looking inside, it's got a petrified cowboy leg. Even the flesh is preserved, and as we look closely at the broken bones, you can see the pus and festered material of the wound that's now rock. And we carried this to the hospital to have the CAT scan done to see what was down in the boot, and we could see the bones were broken there. Well, what name are they going to put on this cowboy leg? They got to have some kind of name. They came back calling it the unfortunate cowboy. We prefer to call him the limestone cowboy. The boot we know to be made by the J. Letty Boot Company in the early 50s from the Stitch Design. When you look at things that are petrified, it doesn't take a long time, like the teddy bear that you'll see back in the museum. You see detailed fossils of jellyfish and ferns and shrimp. You see the polystrate fossils that show continuous sequential layers and the ripple marks. And you see the rapid oil and coal and rapid petrification. Where's the evidence from geology for rapid? Every bit of it, that is for old, every bit of it says rapid. And so I like to talk about the rocks and the layers and the fossils and watch the squirming. Now, why? Well, it's not radiometric dating. That's not a real good reason. It's not the geologic phenomenon. Invariably, that's rapid. And wish we had more time to talk about the formation of rocks, but you have some experience. You know about bricks and you know about concrete, and that, of course, takes a long, long time to... Now, if you get ready to pour concrete, you don't have your forms ready, you're going to be in trouble. Because it's going to set up, and you're not going to slow it down. And that's basically what limestone is. Same chemical formula, calcium carbonate. But there are a lot of evidences for the young Earth, which we haven't really talked about tonight. We've looked at the old Earth evidence. And briefly, in the time that remains, let's quickly look at some that is proposed by W.D. Stanfield, who is the anti-creationist that we introduced earlier. He lists a number of evidences that he acknowledged. Well, yes, this does look young, but he still believes it's old because he has to have that for evolution. He mentions water from volcanoes and lava from volcanoes. All right, how would that indicate an age of the Earth? We've got about 600 active volcanoes in the world today, and about 10,000 inactive, that of course used to be active. And you have to have an average volcano in order to measure rates and to calculate. But let's play the game as they do with the uniformitarian testing, assuming constant rates. And the example of Paracatan is generally considered an average volcano. We watched it form from start to finish, and we know about how much liquid comes out and how much lava comes out, and very studied volcano. And what we find is there's a lot of water coming out. Where the H and the O get together to form the H2O, the juvenile water. A tremendous amount. In fact, 70 volcanoes like this in 1 billion years, not 4.5, but 1 billion years would fill all the oceans. And nobody thinks that the oceans came from volcanoes. 600, we have that active, 10,000 inactive. Just looking at the active ones, that'd fill the oceans 8 times. You see a problem here? This is why Stanfield said, well, yeah, we got a problem here. It's producing enough lava to account for the crust of the earth if you got 4 of them in a billion years, 4 times what you see coming out of Paracatan. If you calculate with 600, you got the crust of the earth 150 times. It gets to be funny, doesn't it? That's not going to work with the young earth view. Some of you know about the pressure in oil reserves. And not long ago, down in the Gulf of Mexico, we tapped into a pressure chamber that they had a real hard time getting stopped, didn't they? Because of the tremendous pressures down there and caused a tremendous amount of damage. But we see when we, in the oil fields, tap into those reserves, it'll blow the material way up into the sky sometimes. Well, if you're a petroleum geologist, you have to know the porosity of the rock so that you know if it could contain oil. And if you know the porosity of the rock, you can calculate fairly easily how long those pressures can be maintained. And you see just a few thousands of years, 10 to 20 maximum, that pressure could be maintained. And there's tons of pressure there, still there. Well, it's been here 100 million years. It's not going to work, is it? You look at uranium accumulation in the oceans and radiocarbon in the atmosphere. This is produced as a result of radioactive decay. If it's been going on 4.5 billion years, then there ought to be a lot of uranium. There ought to be a lot of radiocarbon. Well, when we look at the uranium, the half-life happens to be 4.5 billion years. So that what we've got now is the equivalent of what has decayed if it's a 4.5 billion year half-life. So we measure what we got. We know how much has decayed. We see how much helium ought to be there. There's about 150,000 as much as ought to be there. And similar with radiocarbon in the atmosphere, helium in the atmosphere. Meteoric dust in the strata, it's relatively non-existent. We can measure tremendous amounts of meteoric dust, about 14.4 million tons per year, a significant portion of which is nickel, which is almost absent in the Earth's crust. No, that has not been going on that long. Meteorites, Stanfield says there are none. I think he's mistaken. There may be some, but there are certainly not many. And he's very close to right there, which, I mean, if you've got this geologic column, which, like a tape recorder, is recording 500 million years of time, you ought to have a lot of meteorites over that time, shouldn't you? But if it happened in a year's time, if it's a flood deposit, then you wouldn't expect to find that many, would you? Our view fits. And I think population dynamics is one of the strongest arguments for a young age of the Earth, which people just don't put the pencil to and think about. According to the CIA World Factbook, the growth rate, as we pointed out Sunday, is 1.092%. That's not very much in the U.S. But let's play with the numbers here and do our calculations. In fact, I did this a while back when it was still 7 billion. 8 people from the time of the flood, 4,500 years to today. How many people would there be on earth at this minuscule growth rate? Less than half of what we see today. About 7 billion people. That's about what we see, isn't it? However, let's start with 2 people over 200,000 years. Now, man's supposed to be from Australopithecus to man is about 3.5 million. Modern man been here at least 200. They would say probably 500. But let's say 200 at that same minuscule rate produces 10 to the 398th, which is insane. Now, maybe some of you are not that familiar with the scientific notation. Let's compare that. 10 to the 398th to electrons in the galaxy. 10 to the 65th. Well, okay, we got to go bigger than the galaxy. Let's go to the universe. You go all the way to 10 to the 80th if you include the universe, but you got 10 to the 398th. That is a stupid number. It will not work. And so here this is absurd, and this is right on. This is the way you do science. Which one works? When you look at the evidence for the young Earth, there is quite a bit. And we've just looked at some of it, and much was not included in that first slide that Humphreys had pointed out. This is from the evolutionists. The evolutionist says this is evidence for the young Earth. I think there is a lot of evidence, heavy, significant evidence, for the young Earth. For the old Earth, you got geologic phenomenon, which is all rapid. And you got the radiometric dating system, which involves all kinds of assumptions that have all kinds of problems, as we've seen. Now, which is the better model? Which has the greater weight of evidence? This is the way you do science. You don't just see who hollers the loudest. You look at the facts, and you weigh the evidence. Here, you have more and better lines of evidence. Here, you have fewer and not so good. Can you figure out which one is better? I think it's very obvious myself. The best scientific conclusion, then, is that the Earth is young. I'm not sure we can draw a really fine line from science. I think we can from Revelation. But the best scientific answer, I believe, is thousands, not billions. And if that is true, it hasn't been here all that long. And the one who described its fairly recent creation tells us it's going to end imminently. Now, if you believe the Earth's billions of years old, you don't worry about it ending next Thursday, do you? It just puts a whole different time frame, worldview. You don't worry about it. But if it was just a few thousand years ago, and you can count these generations, and he says, as he described its beginning, its imminent end, in a dependable book, then you better get ready. It may be tonight. Henry Morris, who was often credited with the beginning of the modern creation movement, had a sign in his office that I appreciated. Perhaps today, that he looked at every day. And we need to live that way, and you can live that way if you think the Earth's young. But if it's old, you see that just erodes. It dulls that sharp edge of accountability. But you need to face the reality that you're going to be facing judgment, and it won't be very long. If you're here this evening and not ready, we plead with you to come rendering obedience to the gospel while you have time and opportunity. Because it won't last forever. Come confessing your faith, repenting of your sins, being baptized into Christ. You've wandered away, come back while we stand and sing.